Welcome to You, Me and CPG, a podcast brought to you by Haynes McGregor, brand and innovation partner to some of the biggest brands in the world. Hosted by Jamie Holtham, we sit down with industry leaders and rising stars, putting them in the hot seat. In this series, we delve deep beyond the label and discover the people behind the products. Leading insights, tips and tricks from the top, nothing is off limits. Right, let's get into the pod.
In this episode of You, Me and CPG, we have the talk of the town hot off Dragon's Den. Our guest has spent over 15 years within health and beauty before wanting autonomy and direction, and also fuss-free, does what it says on the bottle beauty products. So she created Face, the straight-talking skincare brand only launched in 2020 and has seen accolades from Vogue, Grazia, Stylist, and is used by celebs everywhere, including now Stephen Bartlett, Peter Jones and Tuukka Suliman. Three offers from the Den just last week in what was a roller coaster episode. But there's so much more to this story. Juggling motherhood, juggling business, juggling life. This story is as real as it gets. Nothing gets sugarcoated, which is just the way we like it. Jasmine Wick-Stevens, welcome to You, Me and CPG.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
No, great to have you on. Right, let's start there. The only place to start, Dragon's Den. How scary was that?
Yeah, I think I said to my husband afterwards, it was one of the worst things I've ever done. I'm over it now, but at the time it was pretty horrendous. I'm not going to lie.
In what sense was it? I mean, it was 15 minutes of TV, as you've just, you know, we chatted a little bit before. It was 2 hours of filming, right? And how intense was it?
Yeah, it was probably about an hour and 45 or something like that I was in there. But it was extremely intense. I think I'd imagined, like I expect a lot of people, that when you walk in there, that it, as it's a TV show, that it would feel like a TV show experience. So if you've ever watched something like a drama or whatever, you expect to see like the cameras and the makeup artists and like a real hive of activity. And I think that's what I was expecting. I was expecting Deborah Meaden to get her face like powdered if it was a bit shiny halfway through the conversation. But it's not like that at all. You step out the lift, you enter the room, and it is just you and them in there. So it's very, very intense because they fire off all these questions at you one after another. And it's for, you know, it could be an hour, it could be 2 hours. It's as long as it takes, as long as they want to grill you for. That's how long you're in there for.
And it is a grilling. This is not for show, right? Like they want to find out about the intricacies of the business.
Oh my gosh, yes. And also I think because they've all got their own angle on it. You know, usually if you're in a conversation with investors, you might be, I don't know, speaking to a couple of people at a time. They'll ask you a question, you'll answer it. You'll also answer it with all of your financials and your paperwork in front of you usually, Let alone kind of having to remember everything off the top of your head. And also with five different opinions on stuff and five different perspectives. So you find yourself a lot of the time having to almost re-answer the same questions over and over again. Which is really tough because, you know, you give your best answer first time round. You don't want to be saying that again. And in there you have to. So, yeah, it's very intense. And don't get me wrong, I really did genuinely feel like they were all kind people that were rooting for me, that didn't want me to do badly in there or anything like that. But it is just the nature of the environment and the fact that it is an investment-led conversation that they are trying to get to the nitty-gritty of the business performance and you as an individual and everything else.
We'll talk about splitting those two things out. Of all the episodes I've watched of Dragon's Den, I've never seen there was a business and then there was an interest in you, wasn't there? There was such a positive energy around you, and there was I think there was some concerns about some of the numbers, wasn't there? I think was the reluctance to maybe invest, but actually the energy around you, you know, I think Stephen Bartlett said you were amazing. Deborah Meaden said she's a star. You know, people, the Dragon said, I want to work with you. That's an amazing achievement, isn't it? You must feel, I know it was a horrible experience or a difficult experience, but you must feel hugely positive about that.
Yeah, no, definitely. I was really apprehensive about the episode because you don't get to see your episode before it airs. So I'm seeing it at the same time as everyone else. And because it was a long conversation, it's human nature that you do naturally focus on the negatives and remember the negative points. Even though I did feel like there was like this really lovely rapport that I'd built with them in the situation. But seeing that on TV, seeing, like you say, the response to me, even when I left, some of the lovely things that they said, of course, that was so, so nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Where did you watch it?
I just at home. I had a little viewing party with close friends and family. Nice. So about a week before, I was like, said to my husband, Dan, I just want to watch it on our own. I'm so stressed about this. I just, yeah, the kind of apprehension was just off the scale. And he was like, no, it would be so nice. So yeah, we just had a few people over and it was so lovely to actually share the moment with everyone.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. So just thinking about the specifics then, ultimately you really got four offers, didn't you? Because I think Deborah Meaden confessed afterwards that she had gone in on the deal as well. So there were three offers with 20K from the Dragons for 5% of the business each. So 15% for 60K ultimately. Interestingly, did you have a game plan that kind of allowed for that flexibility? Because I think at the beginning you said you wanted 60K for 3%. Mm-hmm. So it was a bit different. Was it a gut feel sort of moment to have that flex, or actually was it a bit calculated?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it was a bit calculated, to be honest. I mean, I had to go in there because we've raised money before. I had to go in there with the valuation based on how we'd previously raised, because that wouldn't be fair on my other investors and just wouldn't make any sense.
Yeah.
However, it was sort of pre-agreed with my other investors that actually there was some flexibility there, because of course, it's not just the money with the Dragons, it's the support, the contacts, the profile that they bring to the business. So there is, you know, that has to be taken into account, I think.
Definitely, definitely. You also got, understandably so, because of the intensity, you got quite emotional during the episode. And I think you said you're a crier. And I thought that was quite a powerful moment demonstrating how much you care, right? Like how much effort and grit you've put in to face. Where did that kind of come from? Where did that rise of emotion come from?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I am a crier, but I think because I am so emotionally invested, like Face is my side hustle, which is crazy. And so it started as this passion project. It started as without any kind of financial plan or business plan, which it actually should have, but it didn't. And so it has been a real learning curve. It has been a massive slog over the last 4 years. And it kind of felt like being in the den was like such a significant moment within the journey. I think I just found it quite sort of overwhelming. And yeah, I mean, you don't see this, but I had to pause a lot throughout the whole thing because it was so long. I had to kind of stop, compose myself, go and get a glass of water, have a sip, come back onto the spot where, you know, you have to stand to get the filming right, and kind of like go again a lot, because it was very intense and therefore emotional.
Mm. Now you've got a bit of space in between the episode and now. How do you feel about it overall? What's the general feeling?
Yeah, I mean, just super happy, to be honest. I think I was just worried as well that I wasn't going to come across like myself. I don't know why, because obviously I was myself in there. But you just hear things, you know, like when you're going to be on something, people always want to tell you things, and people often want to tell you the negative things. And that I heard things like, you know, the way they edit you might not be true to yourself and that kind of thing. And so I was just really, really worried. Were they going to piece one thing I said with another thing to make me almost say something that I hadn't intended, for example? And that didn't happen at all. It was very much like I felt like I was watching myself, and I was really pleased that a lot of people that know me well actually sort of, without me saying anything to them, came forward and said, oh, we really enjoyed it because we also felt like it came across true to you. So I think afterwards, knowing that that was the case, I've enjoyed it now. I've just enjoyed watching it. And don't get me wrong, I haven't watched it often. I watched it live with the friends and family. My husband has made me watch it one more time since then. And that's it. That's enough for me. I'm not sitting there watching it over and over again.
I think that's healthy, yeah.
Yeah, but I still feel happy with the end result. I feel happy, of course, that I got the Dragons, but also just generally that the way I was portrayed felt true to me.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And as I said, the Dragons were incredibly invested in you personally. Hey, have you seen a response in sales as a result?
Yeah, we've seen a really significant response in lots of ways. So sales, website traffic, retailer interest, press interest, even consumer feedback has been so nice. I was quite surprised because our sort of menopause face cream has ended up being our bestseller as a result of the show. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily due to the demographic. I actually think it's more to do with the content that was put across for my specific episode. But what's been so nice about that is the amount of menopausal women that have contacted me via social, email, whatever, and sort of said that they just felt like it was really nice to see a brand that speaks to them in the way that Face does. And I guess what they mean by that is maybe not in the kind of stereotypical way that we're not speaking to them like they're old and forgotten and irrelevant. We're speaking to them like they're extremely relevant and almost ageless. You know, like they could be 20, 30, 40, 50, 60. We still speak to them in the same way. And I think that's just been really nice and also massively unexpected. I had no idea that that would be the sort of response that we would get from it.
I think the simple proposition is something that speaks to everyone, doesn't it? I think, you know, clearly there are some targeted products that you have, but everyone gets what it is and what it needs to do, which is, we'll talk about it in the beauty industry, so difficult to actually find a brand that cuts through like that, which Face does. Just on that a little bit, what does it say, if anything, that the three men put money into the business rather than the two women across the dragons? Did you expect the female dragons to resonate more with a brand that talks about the menopause, talks about periods?
Yeah, I mean, I told a little fib to the producers when they asked me if there was a particular dragon that I was going after. I said, no, I'd be happy with any of them. And that is true to a certain extent. But in my heart, I had gone in there really hoping to get Deborah, just because I think, like, exactly like you just said, sort of woman to woman, I expected her to kind of resonate, the story to resonate with her more. And also from a sustainability perspective, we try our best in that aspect. And I felt like she would really be able to get behind us. And also, I've heard on the grapevine that she, out of all the dragons, is the most supportive beyond the show. So I kind of just really went in there hoping for her. And so, like you said, it was quite disappointing for me because, in some ways, because I'd messed up my figure around how much percentage I still owned of the business. So I'd said it was around 40% when actually it's about 50%, which makes quite a bit of difference in terms of us raising money in the future. And just as Deborah was giving me her kind of speech to say she was out, which went on for quite a long time in reality, I can't actually remember how much of it they showed in the episode versus in reality. But anyway, I didn't interrupt her. I realized I'd got it wrong, but I didn't interrupt her. So she said she was out. And then as soon as she said she was out, I said, oh, I've realized the error of my ways. And she was kind of frustrated with me that I hadn't interrupted her. But it's just rude, isn't it? You don't generally interrupt someone when they're speaking, certainly not a dragon. So I kind of kicked myself a little bit about that. You know, I kind of kicked myself that A, I got the figure wrong in the first place, but also B, that I didn't kind of set everyone right once I'd realized. But, you know, at the end of the day, I got like an amazing result. The three dragons that I did get are incredible individuals, all for different reasons. So I can't feel bad about that.
No. And yeah, there's always, you know, there's always an email to Deborah Meaden saying, sorry, I got the figures wrong, but would you like to invest? I guess just reflecting on the specifics of the product and therefore, as you say, the types of the dragons who invested, they invested because of you. They invested because of the business proposition. But I don't know, is it also a sign of the times, I guess, an understanding and a positivity from the fact that you talked about the menopause opportunity with Peter Jones, didn't you? I think that was a clip that they showed. It was great timing because I think the menopause had been kind of headline news that week in terms of employees and employers taking it more seriously. You talked about periods and the difficulty faced by women. How good is that, that there's a level of engagement and awareness at that level from the dragons that I guess arguably 10 years ago, 5 years ago, might not have even been there?
I'm really glad you asked me that question, actually, because, yeah, it was quite amazing for me to be able to put women's health issues like that on national TV and to talk. The whole point of calling period face, for example, is kind of that feministic aspect of it, to be not ashamed of the fact that half of the population has a period and just own it. And so, yeah, it was really nice for me to be able to talk about periods and menopause on national TV and give it that sort of platform and normalize it in that way.
Definitely. And what's the plan now? How involved will those three be? What happens now is always something I think people want to know after you see Dragon's Den.
Yeah, I mean, I think how it tends to work is almost like, you know, they're not going to come knocking down my door saying, how can I help you? Let's be realistic. But they do provide a forum for support. So we've had meetings in person and digitally with their teams. And if there's something in particular that we want help with, then we can go and basically ask for it. So yeah, I mean, we had some really nice social media support from Stephen Bartlett already, which was amazing, on LinkedIn and things like that. So yeah, no, it's almost like that kind of situation. If you want it, it's there. But you know.
Yeah, amazing. So brands, obviously, the face, yeah, it got called out from its simple proposition. The tone of voice is very direct. Speak to us about that realness. Where has it come from? Where did it start from? And what makes the brand so unique like that?
I actually started the brand when I'd become a mum for the first time. So I think I've worked in beauty for, I don't know, about 18, 19 years now, helping other brands sort of tell their stories. And I always sort of knew that I wanted to create something for myself, but didn't have like a, you know, a lot of beauty brand founders will say that they had acne and they found like a miracle cure for it. For example, they have like a personal story to tell. Whereas for me, it was much more about just having that in industry experience and wanting to create something for myself. And just recognizing as well that around me, I had all these amazing individuals. So beauty journalists, skin experts, aromatherapists, and my husband Dan's a designer as well. So he created the brand. He actually came up with the name Face. He's done all the branding and still does. Just recognizing that there was this sort of skill set within, you know, like the sort of team or my network, if you like. We came up with the concept. And yeah, just looking at our own experiences, like I say, I'd just become a mum and I was just kind of like overwhelmed by the whole kind of idea of sort of self-care and looking after myself at that time. And Dan always laughs at me because I always say in interviews that I even sort of bumped brushing my teeth some nights off the list due to sheer exhaustion. He laughs that I sort of open about that, but it's true. You know, we could, I'm sure most people that have a newborn baby can relate to that, let alone kind of doing a 10-step regimen. And it was really kind of popular at that time within beauty to do that. It was like brands like The Ordinary were selling to consumers via sort of single ingredient led skincare and expecting that consumer to A, understand their own skin type, almost be their own skin chemist and layer up, you know, dozens of products to fulfill a routine. So that's great if A, you do know what you're doing, or B, you do have the time. And at that time, whilst I might have known what I was doing, I absolutely didn't have the time. So that's kind of really where the concept of this kind of like simple, straightforward skincare was born from. And also when we were doing our research, we were looking into what was kind of trending within beauty and skincare, and sheet masks were starting to get real negative backlash at that time because they weren't necessarily always very sustainable in the throwaway aspect of the sheet. So originally we launched with three masks, kind of taking that idea of a sheet mask, that consistency of the formula, and putting it into a product that was a more sustainable format, so i.e. without the sheet. So yeah, and then that was kind of like how Tired Face came about, because obviously tired being the new mum. And it was one of my team actually that came up with the idea for period. We were period obsessed within our office, always talking about the fact that how our skin would break out, how we all were all in sync and would come on our periods at the same time. And we had like really open conversations around sort of periods in general. And so I started to look into that. And there wasn't really anything else out there at that time that was kind of so bold in the period messaging. Like I think now there's been a lot of innovation within the period market. There's lots of cool like sanitary towel brands. There's lots of cool period pants, etc. But at that time, it wasn't so sort of prominent. So again, we just kind of like this idea of creating something for your period skin for those times when you know you should do a good skincare routine, but actually life gets in the way of those good habits. And then we landed on Sweaty Face as the third sort of initial proposition, because again, it just felt like, again, quite kind of like bold to own the fact that you've got sweaty skin, but also just tapping into that moment of that really when you're working out and you just want to like leave the gym and get home and you don't want to necessarily do a laborious routine.
Yeah, it's so fascinating hearing you talk, because we talk a lot from a strategic perspective about trying to go from functional to emotional, right? And what you're talking about there is so raw and functional and direct and real. It is in itself gets to an emotional space where the clutter and the noise and the complexity that big beauty brands often have is very difficult to cut through emotionally, right? Because it is in itself confusing. How do you make sure as Face grows that you don't get sucked into that big beauty kind of confusing complex world?
Yeah, I think it's really within our new product development. We're kind of always questioning whether it does kind of go back to our original ethos. So we created Stress Face Cream because we wanted something that was just like an all singing, all dancing moisturizer that everyone could use that would also speak to that kind of simple, like you say, but yet emotive aspect. And stress obviously speaks to a lot of people. And then even now, the way we're kind of innovating, we're not just complicating routines for the sake of it so that we can have a load more products in our lineup and sell a load more products to people for their routine. So for example, at the moment, we're developing an SPF, which I think is going to be Screen Face, but that, you know, we're a small brand, we might change our mind last minute. Dan's literally working on the packaging design today because we've been working on it for weeks, and we just need to conclude it now to get it launched in time, ready for summer. But again, like, that's the missing step. I always say, if I'm like recommending what someone does in their routine, that they keep it super simple, cleanse really well, moisturize, but then provide SPF. And we don't have an SPF in our line at the moment. So of course it makes sense for us to innovate within that next. But beyond that, we're not going to suddenly bring out, you know, 100 different steps and 100 different products, or equally like 100 different faces. So it's about now, I think, like, strategically looking at franchising the lines. Like, I would like to build out maybe the stress line more, especially after Dragon's Den. It now makes sense for us to build out the menopause line more, knowing that that actually has been so well received off the back of the show. But we want to do that in a way that feels still true to our original roots of, like, you know, for menopause, for example, we have been potentially developing a serum, just because our cream is really, really lovely, but it's not massively potent when it comes to sort of, you know, like pro-aging sort of actives. And we get feedback from our customers that they do want something that they feel is going to be really super punchy in that area. So it makes sense for us to then layer up the cream, maybe with a serum that's got some really, you know, whether it's peptides, retinol, whatever, really, really punchy kind of actives in there. But again, that's really sort of purposeful. We're not just trying to sell them another unnecessary step, if that makes sense.
Yeah, super consumer led, right? Like, listening, understanding needs, and delivering for consumers. You make it all seem so simple. I don't know why everyone doesn't do it.
You are listening to You, Me and CPG by Haynes McGregor. If you're enjoying the conversation, please remember to subscribe. And if you have any questions for our guests, get in touch with us. Let's get back to the pod.
Just talking about starting up, was it an itch you always wanted to scratch, or did it come about a little bit more organically?
I think my whole journey as sort of being a business founder was very organic, because I was employed at a company called Scene, which I loved, which is an amazing sort of beauty PR agency. And I never had any sort of desire to set up any of my own businesses. I was always happy being employed and just wanted to kind of progress in as an employee. But what happened was, one of our massive clients was leaving the business, and so I had an opportunity to take voluntary redundancy. And my dad was also dying at the time, and I live in Brighton. He was living in Eastbourne, and I was commuting to London every single day for work, because this was all sort of like pre-pandemic, when everyone worked full-time in offices. And so I would never have taken the voluntary redundancy. They had another role that they thought I was going to step into, and under any other circumstances I absolutely would have. But just because of my dad, I left, and it just left me in a position where I almost needed to set something up. So my husband created the brand Known for me, and just did all of that. I didn't really have anything to do with that. And my sister is a lawyer, so she just did all the kind of legal, set me up as a limited company. And so therefore my first company was just sort of born, but it wasn't like necessarily my dream come true, if that makes sense. And then really fortuitously, just through people that I know in industry, someone through Space NK and other like businesses, I got some clients. So rather than being a freelancer, I ended up being like a business. But then I found out I was pregnant straight away. So I had to then build out a little bit of a team, because I needed to let those clients know that actually they were still going to get serviced. So anyway, this is a long-winded answer, but basically then from there, because I'd then sort of experienced being a founder and an entrepreneur and running my own thing, I guess then it sort of opened up my mind that perhaps doing something else for myself would be really feasible. And then, yeah, from there, I definitely did start to think that actually it would make sense for me to create my own brand, because I'd helped and worked with so many other brands. I just had this sort of really good insight into, especially from a marketing perspective, what it would take to actually make a brand successful.
So Known is the consultancy that you run in adjacent to Face, is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, Known I've had for 7 years.
And I mean, just from a time perspective, how on earth do you run Face? Known, you know, you're a mother, how on earth do you fit it all in?
People always ask me that, and the honest answer is I just work a lot of hours. there's no like oh well, actually, you know, I use this software or I'm like a genius, because it's not anything like that. It literally is just that I work quite a lot of hours, so very flexibly. Like, I have two children, and so my hours are quite unconventional. I might not start work until 10 because I want to look after my two-year-old until that point. But then when he and the other, my other son, Frank, goes to bed, I might then work all evening until sort of 9, 10 p.m. So yeah, and weekends are not off limits. Holidays are not off limits. Like, I don't really probably have a day very often where I don't do something work-wise, and it could be so varied. It can be like a big strategic proposal for a new business client, or it could be packing up a face order. Like, I'll just do everything really that is needed to be make sure that both the businesses are run successfully and my children are still have me being present.
That must be the most real and simple answer, true to the brand that you've built. How do you fit it all in? I work more hours. it's actually really refreshing. You know, there's no smoking gun, right? There's no or silver bullet. There's not an answer to say, well, this is how to be super productive and therefore kind of get everything in. If you're running two businesses and you've got two kids, the answer is you're going to be working really hard and you're going to be working late and you're going to be working some of your weekends and your holidays. But if you want it, that's how you're going to do it, right?
Exactly. And I don't mind. I'm not saying that as in like, feel sorry for me. I don't mind. That's totally my choice.
Yeah.
And it's just prioritizing to you what is important. Like, I don't prioritize a lot of self-care. So I don't really do a lot of exercise. I don't do any cooking. My husband does all of that. Might do a bit of cleaning, but have a cleaner come, once every 2 weeks. And I sort of prioritize my time in the way of my family, my work, and that's kind of it, you see what I mean.
No, that does make complete sense. You had beauty experience then when you started up Face in particular, but you didn't necessarily have kind of product startup experience, right?
None.
how hard was that at the start?
Yeah, it was really hard, and it's been really hard throughout. I think I was quite naive in that I felt like I've created a good product with the team. We've got the kind of like marketing support for PR and things like that, and social media and influencer outreach. So I felt like we kind of had the winning formula. I didn't really think about what else would be needed. And what I quickly realized was actually how much financial investment is actually required to make a business successful. And I had no plan for that. If I could do my time again, 100%, the one thing that I would do above and beyond anything else would be to sit down and almost do like a 5-year financial plan and look at realistically, how much money are we going to need to do XYZ tactic? How much are we going to need to raise therefore? And just be much more strategic in terms of the financial planning side of the business. And therefore, that would have allowed me to look at our opportunities more strategically. So another mistake that we made is launching in too many places too quickly. So with my kind of communications hat on, I know how hard it is to get into certain retailers because I've helped lots of other brands do that. And so when we had retailers actively approaching us, not us approaching them, saying we'd like to stock you, I felt like it was a no-brainer to say yes to that because, of course, that's an amazing opportunity in theory. But kind of what that did, it meant that our opportunities were cannibalizing each other and we weren't a big enough brand at that time to kind of dominate the market enough to kind of drive those sales into that many spaces. And so again, if we'd have done that plan, I would have been able to kind of realize actually, no, to launch there, we're going to require X and we're not going to be able to do that at this stage. So we would have been able to maybe decline some of those opportunities and potentially our sort of path to profitability might have become a bit quicker because we might not have spread ourselves too thinly. And, but I also don't get me wrong, I don't beat myself up about any of these things because if you only know what you know and you don't know what you don't know, and I've come at this from one angle, and I also did it because I wanted to learn. I felt like all the learnings that I could have through Face would benefit the clients that I work with in my other business as well. And they absolutely have because, when we do something and we try something, we see firsthand the results of that, whether they're good or bad, and we can then pass that on, for example. And we've really now got our eyes open in terms of what it takes to launch into different markets, from whether it's like a paperwork perspective, trademarking, whatever it is that you're going to need to invest in. We really do understand that full picture now. Whereas when I first started, I didn't know any of that. And that's something that I've had to almost learn sometimes the hard way over the last few years.
Yeah. And I guess it's the grounding of that real world experience that probably sets you up now for future successes as well. And actually, I'm sure it's maybe difficult to pinpoint, but the fact that you didn't have kind of load of startup experience probably means you did things your own way. You made decisions that, right or wrong, were yours, and you kind of were able to kind of drive your own path a little bit, I guess, potentially looking back. And I just love you talking about the mistakes you made, really owning them, It's really refreshing to hear. Interestingly, that you said, the one thing you would do is sit down with an Excel spreadsheet and go, right, 5-year planning, financial, commercial planning. A lot of people say you know, don't do that because you might overthink it. Not you can't put down things on a piece of paper and expect things to go that kind of that way. What would you say to that? The kind of talking heads to say, oh, you know, just go for it. Don't worry about a 5-year plan.
Maybe those people are coming at it from a more financially secure position, perhaps. So maybe, you know, like for us, we've made a lot of personal investment in the business as well as kind of raising investment. And I guess, you know, if maybe we'd have approached a VC and said initially this is our plan, but give us £1 million and then we're going to run with it, then you would have had maybe more options. So I don't know. It's a hard question to answer because everyone's going to obviously come at it from their own experiences. And maybe that approach does work for some. I can only really talk to it from my experience. I just think that like where we made mistakes, it was just because of that lack of planning, because it was saying yes to everything rather than having like a kind of clear plan of how we would do those things more gradually. So, yeah.
How hard is it to raise money? You mentioned you raised, I think, 450K pre the Dragons. Talk to us about that. You know, how much of a different skill set is that from brand kind of comms marketing? How different is that?
Yeah, it's another whole set of skills on its own. So I've been lucky in that my investment journey hasn't been too tough. So I entered, when I first realized that I needed some money, there was a competition called the Beauty Accelerator, which is by a company called The Red Tree and also SFC. And it was the first year that they'd done it, and they do it every year now. And I entered that and I won that alongside Fussy, which is an awesome brand. So yeah, I mean, I just literally entered that. Of course, it was like a process, and I'm not saying that process was easy, but it was almost like the first thing I tried to do to get investment, and I got it. So obviously that was amazing. And then after that, I just networked to kind of meet angels, and I found an amazing angel and he made an investment. And then after that, I did a Seeders crowdfund campaign, which we brought some of our angel investment money to, and then raised the rest through sort of the crowdfunding process. So although that's been a lot of work, I would say it's not like I've had to be interviewed by 1,000 people to then get that money. Like I've been quite lucky in that, you know, those processes have been relatively smooth for me. And then obviously the Dragons, again, it's a hard thing to do, but I'm lucky that I've come out of it with the result that I wanted. So I'm really, really lucky in that sense. But it is still like a whole new skill set that I had to learn and that you have to learn. And I was lucky that almost the sort of Beauty Accelerator process allowed me to learn on something where, again, the expectation through that wasn't the same as maybe another investment route where they knew that they were looking for sort of beauty startups and they were going to need to nurture you through that process. So there was guidance given to me in terms of like the expectation of the level of documentation, etc., that would need to be prepared. Whereas if I hadn't have done that route and I'd maybe have tried to get investment another way, I would have just had to figure that out all by myself. And again, that isn't my skill set. So I think like it is a whole, if I could have my time again, I probably would almost have got someone who is an expert to kind of consult with me on that and kind of guide me through that from the very beginning, so that I felt really well equipped to go into all those conversations.
And just then kind of economically, what has that money been spent on predominantly? I think you talked about the numbers on the show demonstrated, I guess, just how hard the business is commercially. But where does that spend go? Is it marketing? Is it R&D? Is it recruitment? Where have you invested?
Yeah, mainly on product and stock. So I think another thing that doesn't get talked about a lot is also like the investment that you need to have to keep yourselves in stock, because a lot of investors will look at our stock levels and think that it's too much. But when you actually get into the nitty gritty of how many products we have in each SKU, the minimum order quantities that brands have to fulfill to reach certain targets, whether that's the tube and the outer or the inner fill, et cetera, et cetera. When you actually break that down, the lead times also that it takes to actually either develop something from scratch could be 2 years. It took us 2 years to launch Dress Face, or the lead times to just replenish kind of something that you've already made could be 9 months. So it's really kind of challenging to balance that level of stock that you keep within the business so that you've got enough stock for the opportunities that are coming up. So a significant amount of budget that we've received, like the investment that we've received, has had to go on kind of supporting that process.
That makes sense. I guess that is the sort of the bloodline of the business, isn't it? You know, the product to make sure you've got enough to get into into retailers and make sure you've got enough from a stock perspective. I know you're big on mentorship and you give up quite a lot of your time, don't you, to mentor, which is amazing. So what advice would you give for people who kind of have an idea, believe in it, struggle to kind of work out how to bring it to life and get it out there? I feel like there's a lot of people got this great idea, maybe even have the energy and the determination, but just can't quite do that extra step. What would you say to them?
Yeah, I think like you're going to need to fund it. So I think like I've already said, like sit down and work out sort of what money you think you're going to need. I think also don't be afraid to do a lot of it yourself. You know, like we also felt almost pressurized to bring people in to help with, say, fulfillment or whatever. And actually you can just do a lot of things yourself and really, really save money. So I think whilst you need to do this kind of like financial planning, also don't be deterred by that, because you'd be surprised how sort of frugally you can do a lot of things if you're willing to put the effort in yourself. Network. I would just take learnings from other people. I think like when I say I mentor, it kind of works both ways. So I love to speak to people that are further on in their journey than me, where I can kind of talk about my struggles and they can kind of share their wisdom with me. And then equally kind of the other way around, if there are people starting out, I like to sort of talk to them and share my learnings. And it often is what I've done wrong and what not to do. Because I think like if someone had said to me a lot of the things that I now know, it would take them 10 minutes to explain that to me. It would have saved me, you know, heartache, budget, time. So I think just maybe don't be afraid to kind of find people that are doing what you want to do and try and like connect with them and try and soak up their wisdom. I think like a good way of approaching people as well is just to give them like almost a realistic expectation of what your expectation is. I would love to speak to you for half an hour about X because you've done Y, and that would really help me because I'm trying to achieve this. You know, I'd be really surprised if anyone would be worried about giving up half an hour of their time to support you in that. You know, but if you approach someone and just say, I just want help, if someone's really, really busy and they're a bit overwhelmed themselves, then they might be more inclined to say actually no, because you're not setting an expectation of what help looks like, and they might think that it's just going to be beyond what they can support you with at that time. So I think just, yeah, essentially almost like looking for people that have done what you want to do and kind of getting that help and getting that advice, so that then you understand what the full picture looks like, and then you can decide if you're actually able to take those steps.
I think building network is actually still amazingly quite an underused tool, isn't it, for career in general, but particularly what you're talking about from a startup perspective. I hear a lot of people who are almost too choiceful about their network building. So, I don't want to speak to that person, that they might not be able to help. I don't want to speak to that person, they might not be quite right for me. You don't know any of that until you have the conversation, right?
And people are worried about, I don't know, like competitors. But you should see your competitors as your allies, because there's never going to just be, especially say like a product-based business or even a service-based business, there's never just going to be one. So, you know, why don't see people as your competition, see them as your teammates, and, you know, you can support each other. If something's working well for you, tell them and then it can work for them. Or equally, if it's not, it's the same. I think like that's a barrier people need to get over, seeing people as like competition, that people are going to steal my ideas and all of that. I think, you know, generally people are nice and people want to be supportive. And if you build rapport with someone, I'd be really surprised if people are going to be underhand and, you know, but also like stealing your ideas or whatever, in what sense, how are they, I don't know. You do know what I mean? I just think that people have like a negative perception of how other people are going to react to them. And that, in my experience, that often isn't the case.
Yeah, I think that's really, really good advice. Jasmine, thinking ahead then, what ambitions do you harbour for FACE and for yourself, I guess, within the industry?
For FACE, I would absolutely love to get into a major retailer now. Like, so we're in some brilliant retailers, but I mean, like in terms of the scale, like a nationwide Boots rollout or something like that would be the dream come true for me, to see FACE in hundreds of doors, and then to be able to kind of really lean into that partnership is kind of like the dream for me. And then for me personally, I guess just, yeah, I feel like the good thing about doing Dragon's Den is the kind of sense of personal achievement that it's given me. I really stepped out of my comfort zone. I don't like presenting. I've been on so many sort of presentation skills workshops over the years. It's always the thing that I felt like I don't do very well. Things like kind of the financials as well. You know, whilst I'm good at getting my head around them on paper, I wouldn't say I necessarily have a head for memorizing numbers and things like that. So there was lots of things that I did for that put me out of my comfort zone, that now, because I've got a good result, I feel quite proud of myself. So I think it's just about kind of building on that and still feeling like I'm developing and I'm like doing things for myself that, you know, have that sort of sense of achievement.
Yeah, you should just take enormous confidence from it, because, you know, it's amazing. I think people will listen to this and hear you say that you might think you're not great at presenting. I don't think that's the case, you know, because I think the impact you made on national television that led to investment demonstrates you're pretty special at it. So yeah, I think you should take huge confidence in that. And I don't think you need to go on any more presentation courses personally. I think we do this with all our guests, really. Where do you think is the next big phase or next big growth area within the industry? And I guess focusing on health and beauty, where do you think growth is going to come from across the next kind of 5 to 10 years? If you had a big level of investment and you could put it anywhere, you can't put it into face, by the way. If you were going to put it somewhere, you know, in a trend or in a space that you think is going to grow across the next 5, 10 years, where would you put it?
This is probably going to be a bit of a vague answer, but I think something within sustainability for sure. Mm-hmm. I definitely even find for myself as a consumer that I'm questioning everything that I'm doing. Like, I literally put a black bin liner in my bin today and I was like, this is so terrible that I'm using like black bin liners. I wonder if there's a better solution out there for this. And so I feel like within sustainability, within beauty, for example, there'll be more and more and more innovation, whether it's within packaging. I still don't think that we've ever kind of concluded the most sustainable packaging debate. People will say that it's plastic. Some people will say that it's aluminium. Some people will say it's glass or whatever, you know. So I think there'll be more and more and more innovation within kind of making products more sustainable. I think consumers are definitely buying maybe less and being a bit more considered in their purchases. Obviously not all consumers, but a lot of consumers. So I don't think that, you know, but nonetheless, I still think people will purchase. People will still see that shiny new thing, that beautiful looking thing. So I think, yeah, something within sort of sustainability, perhaps more sustainable packaging or something like that is where things will sort of continue to develop within the beauty industry.
It needs to happen on sort of both sides, doesn't it? It needs big beauty and consumer demand need to drive towards a better future. You know, obviously, if consumer demand really pushes, then the beauty industry will respond massively. But I feel it needs to be in tandem. You know, consumers need to see it and need to then think, well, that's a better option than I have now. And the beauty industry needs to respond in turn and say, you know, we are driving towards a more sustainable future. But I think those two things have to happen in tandem.
Yeah, I agree.
So I think that's all we have time for, really, which is a bit of a shame. But I hope you'd agree that this is ultimately a story for everyone. Someone who has fought tooth and nail to get where she has got to. There's been no leg ups, no winks, no nudges. This is a story of grit, of determination, of creating something that is in itself as real and as true as the founder. It should serve as inspiration, I guess. The time is never right. The stars will never align. It's your responsibility to get your idea out the door, start that business, change your job, whatever it is. It's nobody else's. And I think that has really come through in the conversation today. It's fully in your hands, and that's a scary thought, but it should also be an incredibly liberating one as well. Jasmine, you're the talk of the town. The Dragons are lucky to be able to invest in face. You've been brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on to You, Me and CPG.
Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this episode of You, Me and CPG. Follow us and subscribe on your preferred platform for future insights and episodes where we go beyond the label of leading minds in the industry. If you are enjoying the conversations, find them valuable, or know someone who will, share the episode and leave us a review. To learn more about Haynes McGregor, then visit our website at haynesmcgregor.co.uk. Tune in for next time.